The Providence Journal presents Nick and Bob, the college basketball podcast for Rhode Island and around the nation, with your hosts, Kevin McNamara and Bill Koch.
Hello and welcome to the Providence Journal's Pick and Pop podcast. This is Kevin McNamara with Bill Koch here in Providence, Rhode Island, lovely Providence, on a Friday afternoon and a busy weekend of college basketball here in town. And we're going to start right away with, well, first of all, welcome back, William. We missed last week. You were at you were far away, a little well-deserved, very well-deserved break in the action. And, geez, I don't even know where I was. I think I was in Philadelphia watching the Friars and Villanova.
Correct.
And, you know, it's just not the same without you. So we figured we'd take a little break.
No, I missed you. I missed Bill Corey. I missed the college hoop action around here. I was off the grid for a few days, recharging. Of course, I come home and get sick on the two or three planes that I was on. You know, but those are the hazards of traveling. I think I want to start off the podcast today, Kevin, with a non-college basketball-related thought, and that's on the passing of Nick Cofardo, the longtime Boston Globe writer. I know you and I crossed paths with him in our sort of other duties, me through the Red Sox, you through the Red Sox and the Patriots. You wouldn't meet a nicer person in this industry, and that is even before the kind of professional, the kind of reporter he was. He will be sadly missed. Condolences to his family, to the folks at the Globe, and, you know, obviously to the media members like you who knew him a lot better than I did.
Yeah, this one hurts. You know, I've been doing this for almost 30 years, and for as long as I've been going to Fenway Park, Nick Cofardo was there. He was just always there. Interestingly, yesterday when he passed out and died, he wasn't even supposed to be working, I understand, and still went to JetBlue ballpark down there at Fort Myers, and that's where he was stricken. Red Sox personnel tried to save his life, and to no avail. 62 years old is way too young,
yes,
for anybody, and to die on the job at 62, it makes you think. Anyone who has a chance to go on Twitter today, or maybe it's on their website, Nessun filmed Alex Cora, who talked for 5 or 6 minutes about Nick Cofardo, and anyone who doesn't realize the quality of the depth of character of an Alex Cora, wow, he was great. I don't know if you had a chance to see that, Bill, but
I did see it.
He summed it up an awful lot, and I just can't imagine going to Fenway Park in a couple weeks and Nick's not there.
It's going to be different, certainly. And I'll tell a brief story about Nick before we get into college hoops. You know, last year was my first year on the Red Sox beat, and it's an interesting culture to try to break into because you have, you know, maybe 10 to 15 people who follow the team full time, whether it be home or road. Obviously, at the home games, you're looking at maybe 20, 25 media folks at a given game. So it can be a little bit intimidating. And for someone like me who hadn't been around pro sports that much and certainly hadn't been around the Red Sox that much, I remember being in Tampa for opening day and feeling a little lost. And maybe the first two or three road trips of the year, had dinner by myself every night in the media dining in ballparks. You know, everyone else sort of knew everyone, and I was just kind of there to do the job and not get in their way, I guess. And Nick was probably one of the first people who I started to regularly have dinner with, you know, maybe by May or June into the season. You know, and even in that short time from June through the World Series, I saw all of the things that so many other people have said about him on social media the last couple days. That dry sense of humor, how kind he was, how fair he was, how respected he was. You know, and there need to be more people like Nick Cofardo, not only in journalism, but, you know, walking about in this world. He truly, truly was a first-class gentleman. You know, and someone who will be sorely missed on that beat, on the journalism scene, and just generally.
Going to move on. Tonight, two games. Actually, I'm headed to the east side of Providence to see Brown and Harvard in a key Ivy League game, and you're headed to the Ryan Center to see the URI Rams play Davidson. Before we get into that one a little bit, just want to flash back and bring everyone up to date on the Rams. It's a difficult situation right now for David Cox and his team. Rams have lost 6 out of 7. We're just knocked around to a degree that I didn't think was possible, in all honesty. 76-42 down at VCU in Richmond. Bill, you saw it with your own eyes. I'm sure it was stunning. It really was.
It's two teams going in completely opposite directions. VCU, to me, Kevin, passes the eye test. They're an NCAA tournament team, in my mind. Great depth, very physical. They defend you really hard. Held URI to 13 field goals in this game, forced 20 turnovers. That's how dominant they were at that end of the floor. URI, on the other side of the coin, they just have no confidence right now. None on the offensive end. They can't shoot the ball. Their guards are overwhelmed. The floor has shrunk on that end. They can't get to the rim because defenses are just playing a step back, knowing that they're not going to be exposed from the perimeter. And that's bled into the defensive end now as well. And you can see, you know, maybe that sort of grit, that sort of determination that was there the last two or three seasons, that sort of swagger and confidence is completely gone. And, you know, when you play a quality opponent like VCU, that tends to get magnified and exposed even further. I think we saw that against Dayton on February 9th, the Rams, one of their last two home games, losing by 29 to Dayton. It was a similar scenario that night. And this is just a team that, honestly, Kevin, I look at and I say they need the season to end right now. I'm not sure that anything good is going to come out of the last five games and go into the A-10 tournament. I think just playing this out against more quality opponents might end up doing more damage.
Well, I think the easy question, though, Bill, is what happened between a win over VCU, 71-65 on mid-January, basically in about 5 weeks, the wheels have kind of come off. And I guess you touched on it a little bit. Continually struggling offensively, you eventually lose your confidence everywhere. You know, defensively, I like to say that defense is non-negotiable. Effort is non-negotiable. And I didn't see that, certainly on Wednesday night, Tuesday night, whatever it was, in the VCU game. I do think that they can get it back at that end of the court, but I'm not convinced.
Yeah, they the VCU game that you mentioned was January 23rd. Their next game was at UMass. They lost 77-70. Five of their six worst defensive performances in terms of points per possession have come since that UMass game, including that one. And I think what you're seeing is, you know, players not being rewarded by having that ball go in the basket. And this is such an inexperienced group. You know, even the veteran guys are playing some different roles. There just aren't enough of them. The freshmen have become a little bit crestfallen, and it's just, it's a snowball right now that's going downhill and not necessarily something that they're going to have an answer for anytime soon.
We won't harp on the VCU game because the numbers were truly so bad. But on the defensive side, VCU shoots 51% in the first half, 48% in the second half, 50% for the game. Those are numbers that Rhode Island fans aren't used to seeing from their team. Unfortunately, they have seen these numbers. Fats Russell 0-for-7 from the floor. Tyrese Martin 1-for-5 from the floor. And I actually want to ask you specifically about Jeff Doughton, who's you know, their leader, junior. He's clearly been getting the opposing team's best perimeter player. To Jeff's credit, he had 14 points, team high 14 points in the game, but he is working really hard for clean looks at the basket at this stage of the game.
Yeah, and he's also playing major minutes at this point. He's played 91% of available minutes. That's in the top 30 in the country, and that's simply because, aside from him and Fats Russell, they don't have another primary ball handler that they can put out there. Omar Silverio is a guy who a lot of the fan base are clamoring for. They feel like he can make a shot. He turns the ball over 23.7% of the time, a quarter of his possessions. And for a team who shoots that poorly, they need every opportunity they can get facing the basket. He's not necessarily going to give you that. The defensive end is another story. A lot of folks would say, why isn't Doughton playing as the pure point guard that he was the last two seasons? Well, who's he going to give the ball to?
Yeah.
On the perimeter. The issue is he's their best perimeter scorer. Aside from Tyrese Martin, who sort of hit the wall here the last four games, spent single digits in all four. also a freshman, can't be expected to carry that kind of load. So you look at Doughton, and you look at this team, and you say, he needs to be our best perimeter scorer. That means he needs to be a little more selfish, maybe play off the ball a little bit more. He's got to work really, really hard in a role that he's not necessarily accustomed to. His game might not mesh as well with Fats Russell's as you would like it to. And what you see is just offensive struggles at that end. Guys uncomfortable in spots that, you know, maybe aren't traditionally the best for them. You know, and it's obviously had a cumulative effect to this point where we see URI losing 6 out of 7 going into the Davidson game on Friday night.
So all season long I've been saying that Rhodey is a 500 team. They're going to be pushed hard to be a 500 team the rest of the way. They're 12-13 overall, 5-8 in the league. Here's their schedule. Davidson, the number one team in the league, or second, you know, one or two in the league.
Yep.
Tonight at home. GW at home, I think that's a winnable game. Then they go at Dayton, really tough situation. At St. Joe, you know, St. Joe doesn't do it much for me, but you know, neither do the Rams right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then they end with UMass at home, winnable game. So I guess the question is, can the Rams find their way to 500 overall?
Can you go 3-2 down the stretch?
Yeah.
12-13 right now. You would say that the wins, according to Ken Pom, would be against George Washington and UMass. St. Joe's is a coin flip. It's supposed to be a 71-70 game.
Mm-hmm.
Davidson, to an effect, is a coin flip. Only a 2-point spread in that one. And
really?
Davidson lost by 3 at UMass, who is not a good team. They also lost at St. Joe's by 1, who is also a struggling team.
So they haven't been good on the road.
A different team away from home. I think they're 12-1 at home, 5-4 away.
Probably why, if we look at NCAA tournament situations, Davidson, although with a pretty good record, is probably on the outside looking in as we speak. They have no quadrant one wins, 4 quad two wins, which is interesting. I'd have to look at them and see where they are. But road, let me see their road record. Overall, I have it here, would be only 5-4 away from home. So, you know, have to do a little 11-1 at home, and that's why they're in position to be where they are. So big game for the Wildcats tonight down in Kingston.
Yeah, they're officially in the territory of, you know, we can't stub our toe here.
Right.
They lost a thriller to Dayton earlier this week. That would have been a real nice one to get. Would have been another quadrant two win. They would have been 5-1 against quadrant two, which is pretty decent.
Sure.
You know, Davidson is probably the other team in the league that could make an NCAA run behind VCU, you know, but you would have to see them winning out, probably winning their last 5 games in the league and then reaching the A-10 finals. You know, they probably need to do something similar to what Rhode Island did a couple years ago. Not last season when they just powered their way to the regular season title, but a couple years ago when they got hot late after losing to Fordham. They picked up a real nice win late in the year against VCU at home, managed to make the A-10 finals and then won it. Took care of business on their own. That's also what Davidson did last season. If you remember, the A-10 was a 3-bid league only because Davidson beat Rhode Island in the championship game in Washington.
Right.
The Rams and St. Bonaventure were already going to be in the NCAA field. So, you know, I would say that Davidson, aside from VCU, and maybe Dayton, those are the top-tier A-10 teams who you would think could make a run late, possibly win it all in Brooklyn. I think those three have separated themselves from the rest of the field.
Mm-hmm. We're going to switch to actually Brown just because they also play tonight.
Sure.
The Bears are in a kind of a unique place. They have not played up to par. Mike Martin would certainly say that the first part of the Ivy schedule didn't go as planned. Really haven't put together very many complete efforts. The win here against Princeton at home would stand out as probably the best effort so far.
Mm-hmm.
And with 4 home games in a row, Harvard on Friday, Dartmouth Saturday, and then next week Cornell and Columbia come in, the Bears still find themselves in position to make a run at the Ivy League tournament and the top 4 in the league. But there's not a lot of room for error at this stage.
No, there really isn't. You know, right now, Brown going into that game tonight, they sit at 3-5. They're tied with Penn for 5th in the league. Princeton and Cornell are ahead of them at 5-3. So there's already separation there to try to get to those top four spots. Harvard, who Brown plays tonight, is 6-2. They're in second place. Yale is 7-1. Brown has already lost two games to them out of the block. So, you know, Brown has put themselves in a position where, you know, they're aren't really opportunities anymore. They're a must. And I think I wrote something to that effect earlier this season. It was probably after the second loss to Yale, where time runs really short when you only play 14 conference games, and you probably need to win at least 8 of them to give yourself a chance to get to that Ivy League playoff. And now Brown's at the point where they're probably going to have to steal one against Harvard, or that last weekend at Princeton and at Penn. Mm-hmm. Those games are going to be games that they're not going to be favored in, but that they're probably going to have to go and get.
And the Ivy has been filled with close games. Brown last week, as a matter of fact, losing at Cornell and winning in overtime at Columbia. So it's that type of the other way around. They lost in overtime and won in regulation at the buzzer, and it's been that type of Ivy League season. We'll see if that plays out again tonight with Harvard, you know, one of the more talented teams in the league, in town. We're going to transition to Bryant. Friar fans, relax. It's coming. Only because you were there last night to see Bryant hold off Wagner 67-65, and you came away impressed. You just came away impressed with the way that the Bulldogs are progressing.
You know, Bryant, obviously, it's all relative. You're in the NEC. It's a one-bid league. It's, you know, Bryant is 9-17 overall and 6-9 in the conference.
Interrupting, though.
Go ahead.
Yes, they're in a one-bid league, but the way to win that league is to have a home game. And fourth place, as we look at it right now, is open and is available. And, you know, that would be an unbelievable achievement for Bryant to get a bye in this upcoming NEC tournament.
The 30,000-foot view is that their record isn't that impressive. When you consider what they've done from the standpoint of they've tripled their overall win total from last year. They were a 3-win team. They've tripled their conference win total from last year. They won 2 NEC games. They had lost 5 in a row going into last night, had given up at least 84 points in their previous 3. They hold Wagner to 65 points and got defensive stops the last 4 or 5 minutes of the game in order to pull this one out. This isn't necessarily the type of game that teams who are losing year after year after year find a way to pull out. Bryant was up by 15 at the half. That lead was gone in 8 minutes of the second half. Wagner came out, made a huge rush at the Bulldogs. I think they tied it at 44 all. A huge run out of locker room. And Bryant had the composure down the stretch to reach back in and pull this one out. And I was really impressed just with the way that Bryant is playing. The energy that they show, the life that they have on their bench, they're diving for loose balls, really digging in on the glass at both ends. I think Jared Grasso has done a really good job of sort of instituting that culture that coaches talk about whenever they take a new job or move to a new place. I think he's really got his guys buying in, and I think it shows when you go into last night sort of on the outside looking in to that 18 NEC tournament. This looked like a team that still had something to play for, and it showed for 40 minutes.
Well, they do. You know, again, forget about the 9-17 overall record. It's all about the league, and they're now 6-9 with a very important home game on Saturday against Mount St. Mary's. So, you know, if you have a chance to go out and see Bryant, see what we're talking about, you know, go see them play Mount St. Mary's on Saturday, and they'll have a few more home games down the stretch here. And, you know, I give Bryant a lot of credit, and boy, maybe the most important person in the program is the trainer, because that team was ravaged by injuries the last couple of years, especially last year. Mm. And these are the minutes, 36, 35, 32, 35, 31, 20. That's what their top six are playing. So Jared Grasso does not have a bench, does not have depth. He's just going with his top guys, and no one's getting hurt. And guys like Adam Grant and Sebastian Towns, who were injured last season, are you know, they've been rocks. They really have. And last night, Juan Cardenas, the junior college edition, maybe had his best game. He was 13.7 rebounds, and he's always active up on the glass.
Career high 13 points for Cardenas. You're seeing his offensive game come on here in the second half of the year. You know, the other side of that is, you know, Cardenas made both ends of a 1-1 a couple times down the stretch. He also had a driving baseline layup with about a minute to go that put Bryan ahead to stay. Joe Kasperzak, the freshman from New Haven, made a couple free throws inside the last minute that ended up being the margin of victory. But Cardenas is maybe that extra player who a lot of teams need. You know, if your starters aren't necessarily having a good night, you need maybe that sort of spark plug guy off the bench, and he's, you know, developed into that. He's moved into the starting lineup at this point, you know. But Jared Grasso was using him previously in the year as sort of that sixth man, that sort of lineup changer, game changer. He can be dynamic. He's long. He can block shots. Every team responds to an energy guy like that, and now he's starting to put the ball in the basket. That's an added benefit.
Switching over to the Friars, they will be at home on Saturday noontime against the number 11 team in the country. The Marquette Golden Eagles come into town. Get ready. Marcus Howard will be shooting as soon as he wakes up at the wherever they're staying here downtown.
Was that the last time he was here?
He had 52 the last time. Yeah. So needless to say, he likes the Dunkin' Donuts Center. Probably can't wait to get in that arena.
He's a super player.
He is. You know, somebody asked me the other day, you know, who's your All-American team? He's on my first team. I think he's had that good of a year. He's averaged 25 a game for a team that's in the top 10. You know, I'll take him over an R.J. Barrett, for example, from Duke. I mean, Duke's, you know, a great team and all. I think Zion's the National Player of the Year. But why would R.J. Barrett, you know, merit votes ahead of Marcus Howard? He's really had an outstanding season. This is Steve Wojciechowski's best team. He has the two Hauser brothers, Sam and Joey, alongside. That said, Marquette is not running through the Big East, although their record says otherwise. They have a chance to win the outright Big East championship down the stretch here, but a win at Providence, needless to say, same thing. Can't stub their toe if they want to be a top 3-4 NCAA seed and want to win a Big East championship. They have to take care of business against the Friars.
Yeah, and if you're Marquette, this is a good test of your focus because you have Villanova up next on the road, which is obviously the showdown game in the conference and will go a long way towards determining the regular season title. You know, Providence, in their case, played reasonably well at Marquette earlier this year. That was at the end of January. They lost 79-68, a game that they were in the whole way. Marquette, you know, sort of spread it out at the end with some free throws. You know, but I think Marquette, the biggest thing for them is if they're making shots, they're really tough to beat, but they don't necessarily have a plan B. They don't really have, you know, sort of a road grader inside. Theo John, it might be the closest thing to someone who can dominate you physically, but both of the Hausers, Sam and Joey, they want to beat you on the perimeter. Marcus Howard obviously wants to beat you on the perimeter. That's sort of the style that they play. And, you know, I'd like to see Providence try to be physical with them and try to, you know, maybe make this game a rock fight. Get the crowd into it. You know, maybe throw some elbows early. Have some energy. You know, get some defensive stops. And, you know, maybe bring Marquette into the mud. I see that as probably their best chance to win the game.
No, I totally agree. The problem is you tell me what Providence team you're going to see. Is it the team that last Saturday against Xavier probably played the worst half at home in Ed Cooley's time at Providence, where Xavier just ran past the Friars in a 75-61 win, or the team that showed up on Wednesday night against St. John's and just kind of took it to the storm right out of the chute, held St. John's to 36% shooting, no one really got going, and Providence wins going away 78-59 in their most dominating home Big East season, you know, win. Tough to say, and maybe that's the Friars right now. Ed Cooley, I don't know if he knows what to expect from his team.
Well, I know one thing. I would expect them to hammer St. John's every time they play them because they've done that twice now.
They'd like to see them in the Big East tournament, I can tell you that.
Really, I mean, it's the old boxing axiom, styles make fights. They've beaten St. John's twice.
8 out of 9.
You know, by a total of 33 points this year. Now, the first time, they played them without Mustafa Heron.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching that game and thinking to myself, they're going to play them again in 2 weeks. Mustafa Heron's probably going to be healthy. St. John's looks like an NCAA tournament team to me. They're probably, you know, among the last few at-large teams to get in. But I think right now they're solidly in the field.
Right.
And Providence made them look very average the other night. You know, Nate Watson continues to play very well. I think he's been good the second half of the season. And Providence managed to find enough perimeter answers even after Mekhi Ashton-Lankford went out early with an ankle sprain. It was probably the most complete performance offensively and defensively that I've seen out of the Friars in goodness knows how long.
Yeah, it was, and again, I wouldn't say unexpected, but it's just tough to know what to expect from the Friars right now. You know, they continued to not get very much from their freshman guards, David Duke and A.J. Reeves, and yet Malik White showed up. He had 11 points, a couple assists, 4 steals. He's been nothing for about a month. Isaiah Jackson has really struggled most of the Big East season. He comes up with 11 points and 9 rebounds. You know, you just liked, and 5 assists. You know, you'd like to be able to count on those upperclassmen, Jackson, a senior, White, a junior, Drew Edwards, a redshirt senior, and those guys have been actually way more inconsistent than even the freshmen. And I think the combination of the two, that lack of leadership in the upper class and then freshmen being freshmen, has made the Providence a true a Dow Joneser, as Dickie V would say. Up and down, you have no idea what you're going to get. What's interesting, Bill, is, you know, the Friars are 5-9. They have 4 games left, 2 at home, 2 on the road. They could finish anywhere from 3rd to 4th and truly have a bye in the Big East tournament, which would be amazing. Or they're playing on Wednesday night in the play-in games in the Big East tournament, which they have avoided since the Big East reformulated itself 6 years ago. So an awful lot in the hopper for the Friars. They, again, host Marquette. Then they go to Butler and Creighton and then end with a game against Butler down the stretch. So, you know, Butler is the team that is definitely right on the bubble, will need wins. Creighton's Creighton. You know, they're going to score a lot of points and be tough to defend.
Mm-hmm.
The Friars, I look at it, they could lose every game and maybe they could win every game.
Well, I think outside of Marquette and Villanova, you could say that about everyone in the Big East.
Right.
Those two teams have a 4-game lead in the loss column over everybody else. St. John's and Seton Hall are both 7-7. Georgetown is 6-7. Butler and Xavier 6-8. Creighton, Providence, DePaul, all 5-9.
2 games back.
Which is, you know, it makes no sense. It's completely wild. Now, I look at this and I think to myself, Marquette and Villanova are certainly in and probably...
St. John's is in.
You know, I would say that...
Yeah, they'd have to lose. If they lose out, we have problems.
But I would say that Marquette and Villanova are going to be fighting for top 4 seeds in the tournament.
Yep.
You know, maybe no worse than 5 seeds in the NCAA tournament. No worse. You know, no matter really what happens the rest of the way. I think St. John's and Seton Hall will probably get there. Seton Hall has a little more work to do than St. John's at this point. 16-10 overall, 7-7 in the league, 61st in KenPom, which isn't great, but you know, they're going to have opportunities down the stretch. From there, who's going to emerge to be the 15th?
Yeah, I think it's Butler. You know, on the net rankings, Butler is 50. Seton Hall is 64, so they have a better profile in the net, which is, you know, is what they use. But they need some more wins.
Right.
You know, there's no way that the Big East should get a team in the tournament this year with a less than 500 conference record. So they better get to at least 9-9. And if I'm any of those Big East teams in that muck, they better get to 10-8. And then they have something to crow about. And obviously, if they can grab a win over Villanova or Marquette the rest of the way, that changes things. I'm not quite sure who Butler has outside of the 2 games against Providence the rest of the way. But, you know, the lack of quad one opportunities. Right now, for example, Providence has 3 quad one opportunities left. Marquette, Butler on the road, and Creighton on the road.
Butler has 1. They're at Villanova after they play Providence.
Well, there you go.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. And, you know, Providence on the road will... Actually, that could be quad one win because Providence right now is 71. So they have a,
yep, goes to 75. Yep.
So
a
few more opportunities for Butler, and you know, we'll see. We'll see. It'll be interesting. Hey, Bill, before we sign off, I wanted to give a hats off to one of my favorites. Jamel Thomas is getting into the Providence Hall of Fame tonight, the Providence Athletic Department Hall of Fame.
Okay.
And will be honored pregame or halftime of the Marquette game. I've been doing this a long time. There's a few players who stand out over the years, not only for their talent, but for their stories. And Jamel Thomas's story is one of the very best, from Coney Island, Brooklyn. Basketball background. His cousin was Stephon Marbury, so he kind of grew up in his shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Comes to Providence as a diamond in the rough in a great class with God Shamgod and Derek Brown and Ruben Garces. And he ends, he's obviously a key part of a team that went within a jump shot of the Final Four in 97. And he graduates top five all-time leading scorer in the history of the school. He's now 42 years old,
yeah,
which is scary.
How does that make Kevin Mack feel?
50 plus, yes. Teaching and helping kids in New Jersey play basketball.
Yeah,
has a family of his own, and talked to him this week. He's really, really excited about coming back and seeing his friends in Providence.
You know, I think the great thing for a guy like Jamel, and this is going to sound strange, but for him to be sort of off that NBA scene early, was undrafted, signed with the Celtics, ended up with the Warriors, kicked around with the Nets a little bit. Then he got to go overseas. And I think for a lot of these guys, it's your career can be what you make it if you're a sort of fringe NBA guy. If you embrace the fact that you can go over to Europe and live there for 8 to 10 years and be in three or four different countries and sort of embrace the culture, embrace the sort of rabid fan bases that you can see there. I mean, you've seen some of those games online.
Yeah, and he really did. He had a great run in I know it was Italy for a while, but Germany and somewhere else.
Played in Turkey as well.
Yeah.
Played in Greece a little bit.
You know, really matured. And really, when he came here at 18 years old, as tough can be.
Well, and that is a long, long way from Coney Island. So you have to appreciate the opportunities that would give someone like Jamel Thomas just for personal development and for, you know, to sort of expand his worldview in that way while playing basketball. You know, someone like that, I would imagine, would appreciate how blessed they were to have the career that they did. You know, I think back to the player that he was at Providence. And, you know, the one thing that stands out to me was just how easily he scored the ball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, throughout his career, every once in a while he could be a little bit of a volume shooter. But I think that's the curse of a guy, you know, the blessing and the curse of a guy who can score it as easily as he did. I'm sure that he looked at his teammates and thought, guys, give me the ball and I'm going to carry you the way.
I'm the man. As a junior and a senior, he played on good teams as a freshman. The really good team was as a sophomore. And then everyone left. You know, Austin Crozier went to the NBA.
And Shamgod.
Shamgod left early, Garces, went to the NBA. And all of a sudden it was Jamel, here you go. And he averaged 18 and 22 as a junior and a senior. So it's a lot of shots, a lot of points. Welcomed Tim Welsh into college basketball because he also had to deal with a coaching change.
That's right.
So he had a lot going on in his 4 years in Providence. But congrats to Jamel. Also congrats to Dr. Al Perini. Long, long time team physician. He's also going into the Hall of Fame.
We should also spare a word for Al Skinner, the former URI coach. Announcement came earlier this week that he's going to step down at Kennesaw State. You know, and you have to wonder, is this going to be the end for Al Skinner and the long, you know, prestigious career that he's had in coaching?
Can't see how. That's kind of the message that I got. Is he's walking away. He's you know, gave it a shot at Kennesaw, a really difficult situation at a small school outside Atlanta. He just wanted another shot to be a head coach, and I think this is 4 years. It's what it is, and Al certainly had an unbelievable long run, successful run at both URI and Boston College's all-time winningest coach.
Yeah, which is, you know, you consider the tradition of a place like Boston College, what it did before it got into the Big East, and then obviously during its tenure in the Big East, moving on to the ACC, you know, Al had that program competitive. I think he made the NCAAs, I want to say, 8 out of his 15 seasons there.
Yeah, that sounds about right. With a lot of pros.
With a lot of pros. I think the one thing that might have undone Al was, you know, sort of the rise of the internet and the fact that marquee assistants like Bill Cohen and Ed Cooley got their own jobs.
Yeah.
Because Al always had a way, and those assistants always had a way of pulling out a guy like Craig Smith or mm-hmm. Troy Bell, who you never saw coming. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they're pros. And you're like,
Jared
wow.
Dudley.
Yeah,
you know,
right. And you're like,
guys.
Where did he get this guy from?
Yep. Reggie Jackson.
No question.
Sure. Now, really good staffs over the years. Tim O'Shea and Pat Duquette also went on to head coaching jobs. And I think a lot of people would say he should still be at Boston College. But is what it is. You can't coach forever. Can't have these jobs forever. But Al, certainly, hats off to him. He had a great, great career. That's it, everyone. Enjoy the games around town. And we will be back next week. Thanks very much.
See you all soon.